It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Packers will be playing their second game of the season. They're at home this Sunday at Lambeau Field.
And among the fans on Sunday, one Wisconsin group is planning a protest.
They have nothing against the Packers or the game of football. They're protesting the team playing against Green Bay, the NFL team from Washington. The concern? The team's logo. The Redskins.
The Wisconsin Indian Education Association's Indian Mascot and Logo Task Force will be leading that protest. They're saying that Washington's mascot is discriminatory and they want to see it changed.
Joining us is Barbara Munson of the Oneida Tribe. She's chair of the Indian Mascot and Logo Task Force. She's at UW Green Bay today leading discussions about the mascot. Barbara, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
So can you talk about why you'll be protesting at the game on Sunday?
We will be protesting at the game because we are Packer fans, and the Packers were originally the Indians, and they had the grace to change their team name many, many years ago. And we now know that Indian mascots and logos are harmful to our nation's school children, and we would like the Washington team to think deeply and consider changing its race-based, stereotypical nickname and logo.
A lot of people have heard the concern that the Washington logo and a lot of other logos are offensive. You said harmful. How are they harmful?
We don't use the term offensive when we're talking about this issue because our primary focus is in Indian education. And our primary focus is to eliminate Indian mascots and logos from Wisconsin public schools. Over the years, a research base has developed that clearly demonstrates that Indian mascots and logos are harmful to American Indian students and that they are also harmful to other students, to all our students. They teach our students to tolerate race-based stereotyping, the practice of race-based stereotyping, and they are harmful to Native students. So knowing that, and the research base has grown over the years, so what was just one study in 2002 is now hundreds of pages of research studies in various psychological disciplines and in other areas as well. And we know that these are harmful to Native students. We know that they lead to a generalization so that people who are exposed to Indian stereotypes have a greater tendency to stereotype other minority groups, Asian Americans and African Americans, et cetera. So in a way, the race-based stereotypes that we are holding up over our nation's sports teams are also a vehicle for decreasing tolerance and for harming children.
The argument from people who support these team names who don't want changes is often something along the lines of, this is honoring the people represented here in our name. What do you say to that?
When the people, when Great Lakes Intertribal Council and Wisconsin Indian Education Association, the National Indian Education Association, the National Congress of American Indians, and other American Indian organizations in a loud, clear voice say for many, many years that it is not honoring us and we really want you to change these, it's time to change. But beyond that, when you know that a practice in society is harmful to children, it's time to change.
There's been a lot of attention to this case in particular, the Washington team. A lot of sports writers, some sports writers now saying they're not going to use that logo name. They'll refer to the Washington team only. Do you see the tide turning, at least in this one instance?
I certainly do, and I applaud the media for making the effort to reach out and understand the issue on its deeper levels. It's taken a while to get this to happen, in part because these stereotypes have remained in our nation's sports teams. But really, this is a form of race-based stereotyping that should have gone out with blackface minstrel shows, and if not, at least with the Frito Bandito.
With this name in particular, people have said, even if you're okay with other logos, other team names, Redskins, I'll throw that in quotes, is particularly offensive. Some people have made the case it's on the line of the N-word, which I just said one on the air and I just didn't say the other. Huh. What do you think it's on a par? Do you think this is a particularly offensive one?
I do not use the term that you used. Nice. I refer to it as the R team, mm-hmm. or the Washington team. I find it easy enough to say Washington team, and I hope someday they'll have a mascot or logo that isn't harmful to anyone, any human group. And then, you know, then they can be proud of their name, and we all can enjoy the game.
So what will your protest look like on Sunday? What will you be doing?
Well, we're going to be doing some artwork. We'll be going over to the Oneida Nation Arts Cottage tomorrow and creating posters for the demonstration. We have a lot of brochures and handouts, and we will be standing on the corner of Ridge Road and Valley View at the southwest corner of Lambeau Field, and we will be there voicing our opposition to the visiting team from Washington.
If you had a chance to say one line or two to the owner of Washington's team, hoping to change his mind on this because he has not shown a lot of willingness to change the name so far, what would you say?
I would say that he has a great opportunity to be a good citizen. And to change an archaic race-based stereotype into some wonderful logo, we don't know what it is, that harms no one. But what's happening right now is he is going from one part of the country to another with a logo that actually harms children. It's time to change. It's time to change.
Barbara, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Barbara Munson, chair of the Indian Mascot and Logo Task Force, the Wisconsin Indian Education Association.
Coming up, we'll hear about the 50th anniversary of a piece of American audio culture known as the audio cassette tape. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Saw this in the news. Today is the 50th anniversary of the official release of the audio cassette tape, and if you reckon it one way anyway. That got us thinking. A lot of memories flooding back here in the Central Time headquarters.
And we've got producers Chris Molina and Galen Druk to share their stories now. Now, the audio cassette, this is this tiny little plastic thing, came unspooled in your car and you had to thread it again with a pencil. But you guys have some fond memories of it. Chris, what's your memory?
Yeah, well, for the longest time, I only had a car that, well, I mean, it had a radio, but it also had a cassette tape player. So for years and years and years, I drove around listening to cassette tapes. And I used to go to the thrift store. I used to go to St. Vinny's over on Willie Street, where you could get cassette tapes for 25 cents a pop. And that seemed like a great, cheap, and easy way to listen to music in the car. But then, you know, I finally got a car. My old car, you know, kind of junked out. So I had to get a new car, and that had a CD player. So I had to get rid of all those cassettes. So they went right back to St. Vinny's, and hopefully someone else is getting able to enjoy them for 25 cents
a
pop.
It was the end of an era.
It was, and I miss it.
What about you, Galen?
Well, I remember cassette tapes as the old way of ripping music. So my brother and I shared a room, and we would sit by the radio all day waiting for a Britney Spears song to come on so that we could press record and then record the tape from the radio. And then you'd sort of label the tapes with a pen and wind them up with a pencil, you know, when they got out of control. But yeah, no, now they're collector's items. Although they're kind of making a comeback, right?
In a kitschy kind of way, it seems like. No one's going to go to a cassette tape for high fidelity.
Well, right. In a vintage kind of way.
In
the same way that,
right.
Like, people go to, you know, record stores now.
Uh-huh.
I was at a record store. It's kind of a well-known record store in New York. And it used to be just records, and I went in, and now there's sort of two rows of cassettes. So yeah, I think they're making a comeback.
Well, and the thing that's weird to me is we're riding this huge wave of 90s nostalgia right now, and I mean, that's kind of what I grew up with, and I feel like it's, you know, we're all, you know, hitting that age right now, you know, because Galen and I are, you know,
making
of a similar
us feel
age.
Old.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, stop it. Both of you just stop it. I don't want to hear about your elderly feelings at this moment. But cassette tapes, well, do you miss them? Would you take them back?
No.
Yeah.
No, I mean, they're nice, but I'd much rather rip my music in a much, I don't rip music, just for the record, but in a much more in a much easier way.
And you know, it was a nice thing to remember, but I'm not sure I'd go back either. But
yeah,
it holds a nice spot in my heart.
I think most of us feel that way. All right, guys, thanks so much for coming by.
Hey, thank you
so much.
Well, now that football season has finally started, so is tailgating season. Whether it's for the Packers, the Badgers, or for whatever team you love, tailgating is a tried and true football tradition.
One of the most important parts of any good tailgate is the food. Amy Hansen is with us, the cooking mom. She's a blogger and a cookbook author. Amy, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Well, you shared a few classic tailgating recipes with us. Some good-looking stuff. One of my favorites, the brat tub. What is a brat tub, and how does that work?
Well, a brat tub is my way to do brats. You know, I don't want to miss a thing when I'm having a game day party. And I live in Green Bay, so we do game day parties really, really well. We're all pumped about the season opener at Lambeau Field. And I hate that when, you know, the best play of the game happens and I'm outside manning the grill, or in my case, womaning the grill, or in the kitchen. So don't let that happen to you. Or if you're tailgating, you know, you want to be hanging out with, you know, everybody at your party. You don't want to be manning or womaning the grill the whole time. So what I do is I start my brats and get them going, and then I take one of those big aluminum, those foil pans, and add a stick of butter to that pan along with a couple of sliced onions, a few bottles of beer, just depends on how many brats you're doing. Now I got your interest, don't you? Got some beer in there.
Brat, beer, and butter.
I know you hit all the major food groups in Wisconsin,
yeah,
I think.
You had me at brat, beer, and butter.
Just left one thing out. As I've gotten older, I've come to love sauerkraut. Didn't like it at all as a kid, but now I love it. I'm not sure exactly what that means. So you dump a full container of kraut in there, too. So you got your butter, your beer, your onions kind of simmering, hanging out, warm and cozy. And then you, when the brats brown up, you take the brats and you put them in what I call the brat tub on indirect heat. Just keep them low and cozy and warm, and everybody can then help themselves. So you don't have to be hanging out at the grill the whole time.
And so
that is completely the way I roll at my game day parties.
They don't get, you know, kind of soggy from being in this lovely little stew of butter and onion juice or kraut juice?
No, in fact, they keep nice and moist. They don't get dry, and you're keeping it on really low heat.
Huh.
You're just kind of, you know, putting it to the side of the grill, indirect heat. So it works out perfectly. I promise you, you got to try it. Go to my website, and you can find out how to do it.
I got a question, and this is heresy to some people. I boil brats first, then throw and make sure they're cooked, and then I just grill them to brown them. Do you pre-boil them here, or are you doing exactly the opposite of what I do?
You know, everybody has their own way of doing it. And, you know, I don't want to change anybody's way. And so, yeah, you know, it's nice to boil them ahead of time in your case, because then you don't have to worry about them not being cooked. But, yeah, I do it the opposite way. I get them grilling first and then get them in that wonderful brat tub of goodness. And they kind of finish cooking there and stay nice and moist in that. But either way, you know, like I say, I'm not going to change the way you do it. It's going to be good no matter what. But give my way a try, Rob. I think you're really going to like it.
It's got
the onions and the kraut all in there, too, which I love.
Well, you've got my interest with the next thing we're going to talk about. It involves copious amounts of cheese. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, you know, I say every Wisconsin party has to have a cheese ball. So in both my cookbooks, I have a lot of different cheese ball recipes. And this one's a fun one. It's actually, you can do it in the shape of a football, and it's super easy to do. I love make-ahead, so like tomorrow I'm going to be cooking up a storm so that I don't have to be in the, you know, like I say, in the kitchen the whole time during the game. So I can just set my game day spread out, and everybody else can, you know, help themselves. So this one is basically cream cheese, a couple of packages of that, some sharp shredded cheese, an 8-ounce package of that, some Parmesan cheese, a half a cup of mayonnaise, a couple teaspoons of Worcestershire sauce, a little bit of garlic powder, a little bit of black pepper, chopped scallions, and then a quarter cup of bacon bits. So you mix that all together with a mixer and then form it into a football, which is really easy to do. It's not all that hard to do if you, you know, just kind of use your hands. And I put my hands in plastic baggies to kind of shape it. And then roll the football or press the pecans, chopped pecans, or you can do bacon, more cooked crumbled bacon if you don't do nuts in your family. So cover the cheese ball with either nuts or bacon and then use roasted red pepper slices, just the jar of red pepper slices, to make the laces. Or you can do just slices of cheddar cheese to make the laces. And this acts as not only a great dip, I serve it with crackers, but also makes a really nice centerpiece for your game day spread.
Do you need a special breed of cracker, or am I going to be breaking off the crackers every time I dip in there?
Well, I use a little spreader, but you know, if this is sitting out a little bit, it should be fine to spread, and it's just delicious. And like I say, it looks super duper cute on your, you know, whether you're going to a tailgate or having a party at home.
And you know what, Rob? I can introduce you to a hearty little friend of mine called the carrot stick that will not break off in the massive cheese thing.
That's just empty nutrients, though. I don't know.
I mean,
with all this
that?
Cream cheese and stuff, man, I'm going to go all the way.
All right. Well, you know, one of the hardest parts about hosting a game day party is you have to spend so much time in the kitchen. Is that what you're really trying to do here, Amy? Maximize your time watching the game and not being the one who's trotting around sweaty in the kitchen?
Totally. You know, we've all had that party where everybody leaves and you're like, I'm never doing this again. It was way too much work. So a couple of my tips is, you know, you don't have to do 53 different dishes. Just do a few things, do them well. I just put a great recipe on my site for beef teriyaki kebabs. We're in grilling season right now. So, again, these are something you can make ahead. It's just a quick marinade for some steak, and then you thread it on skewers. I love kebabs, a little dressier than brats and you know, burgers. And then if you're doing, you know, for the Badgers, you can do red peppers and onions on the skewers. For the Packers, I did pineapple and green pepper on the skewers. You can get them all done ahead of time and then just fire up the grill right before kickoff. So that's a great make-ahead. I also do a layered trifle dessert with pound cake or angel food cake and your team's colors. So, again, in the case of the Badgers, you could do cherry pie filling and, you know, a cream cheese or cheesecake pudding. For the Packers, I do one with angel food cake, a pistachio pudding, a vanilla pudding and whipped cream and green and gold sprinkles on top. Again, a great make-ahead. The kids love it. You know, football in Wisconsin isn't just about the game. It's just about everything that goes along with it. So don't forget those kiddos. My passion is to get kids into the kitchen and get families eating together and really make game day a memory for people. So lots of great recipes and ideas on my website.
Well, you mentioned those beef teriyaki kebabs. Did I see brat kebabs on your website?
Yeah, you know, again, that's another way to kind of take your party to the next level. Anybody can throw brats on the grill, and I love that. But just, you know, stepping it up just a notch, pre-cooking your brats as you did boiling them, or you can buy the pre-cooked brats. I do a quick, easy marinade with a little bit of soy sauce, apple juice concentrate, a little bit of Dijon mustard, and again, chop up some peppers in your team's colors and onions, thread them onto skewers. Brush the brats and the vegetables with, you know, a little bit of the reserve marinade. And then I love to serve brat kebabs with a spicy or a German mustard for dipping. And it just, you totally look like a rock star. And, you know, who doesn't want to look like a rock star? I'm not a chef. I'm just, you know what, I call myself the cooking mom. But I love looking like a really cool cat at my game day party or my tailgate.
So I got to ask you, Amy, you're awfully excited about the food. Are you an actual flesh and blood football fan? Or is it more about getting to eat more cheese and pork-based food on Sundays?
You know what? You've got to be in Wisconsin. I live in Green Bay. His very first words, we drove by Lambeau Field, and Lambeau Field sits right in the middle of town for people who don't know. Well, I'm sure, you know, everybody in Wisconsin knows. So we're driving, you know, out of the Kmart parking lot, and my son is in a car seat in the back, not even a year old, points up at the stadium and says, Packers. I mean, it was like, you know, it's just the way we are. So, yeah, you betcha. I'm going to be watching the game for sure, and they better win this one. Last week wasn't so good, so let's move on from that and have a great season and great food, too.
You want to give a pep talk? I mean, I don't do this kind of hosting a lot. A quick pep talk on the less ambitious among us to get out and do this, either tailgate or host that party and make some awesome food?
You know what? It is so easy breezy. I have some recipes in my cookbook and online that are like four ingredients. Throw it in your slow cooker. You know, pulled pork sandwiches with just ginger ale and some barbecue sauce. three or four ingredients. Anybody can, you know, dump things into the slow cooker, pick up some buns, take help where you can get it. The grocery store has a lot of great stuff. If you are hosting a party, people always say, what can I bring? Don't dare tell them nothing, because they're going to come with something anyway, and then you're going to end up with eight different potato salads. So be specific and say, hey, do you mind, you know, bringing dessert? And then you've got different bases covered. Dips are just so easy. You can't have enough dips, and I just put one online that's really fresh and healthy. I think some healthy alternatives to all that, you know, not so healthy football food is really important. A veggie and dip tray. I do a dip called Texas caviar. Don't worry, no caviar in there, but it's just basically corn and beans, which is great this time of year, fresh sweet corn and
sounds
pepper,
good.
Jalapeno pepper, cilantro. Toss it together the night before, serve it with baked chips and dip away guilt-free.
Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, I hope whatever team you're rooting for, they win, and I'm rooting for the Pack, so go Pack. Thanks, guys.
All right. That was Amy Hanton, the Cooking Mom, and you're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Like it or not, we live in a digital age. Every day we're surrounded by computers and tablets and smartphones. And soon we'll probably be wearing interactive glasses from Google. But is all this technology making our lives better?
Joining us now is Clive Thompson, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and Wired. His new book is Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. By the way, he'll be presenting at the Wisconsin Book Festival Friday, October 18th at 5:30. Clive, welcome to the show.
Welcome. Good to be here. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you open your book with some anecdotes about the intersection of our brains and technology and chess. We had Garry Kasparov, the famous chess player, against the Deep Blue computer, leading to kind of an us versus them mentality. That's kind of a starting point in your book and how it isn't necessarily us against the machine. Talk about why you started there.
Well, you know, I got very interested in this question of Deep Blue as kind of a metaphor for what's happening to us. Because, so, Garry Kasparov was beaten by Deep Blue, and a lot of people said, well, this is terrible. This is the moment when humans are no longer relevant because machines are better at us than a chess. But what Kasparov did after that was very, very interesting. He said, well, okay, maybe a machine is better at doing this brute force sort of reasoning, you know, like going seven moves out, you see every possible play, and you can beat a human that way. He said, well, rather than compete with the computer, why don't I collaborate with it? And he invented a form of chess called advanced chess, where it would be playing with one team, a person and a computer, versus a person and a computer. So the human could essentially use all the smarts of a computer to play even more complicated chess than they could ever do on their own, you know? And this is exactly what happened. People started playing advanced chess, and they began to produce these chess games that were so fascinating and creative and brilliant that they could never have done on their own. The computer couldn't have done it on their own. The human couldn't have done it on their own. But together, they could do remarkable things. And that's a sort of I regard that as a great metaphor for all the stuff that we're doing online these days.
We'll return to that theme through as we talk now, but there's a sense, there's a lot of messages out there and articles and books even, relying on technology makes us more shallow thinkers. Relying on technology, outsourcing our thinking is making us dumber in the short version. Is that a real common sentiment out there, do you think?
You know, I think I definitely hear it a lot, you know. People tell people, you know that I write about technology, and so they'll ask me, they're like, wow, I'm really worried that I'm getting stupider because I'm not remembering things, or, you know, I'm becoming shallow because I'm writing all these tweets. And I think some of that is innate, you know, sort of, and I think healthy concerns about change. And there's also been an awful lot of sort of very worried op-ed pieces and books lately, you know, things like Nicholas Carr's The Shallows, which worried about the fact that we don't have any time for contemplation, or Sherry Turkle's book Alone Together, which was concerned that, you know, we don't actually spend any time with each other anymore. So there's definitely been a sort of a concerned cultural conversation that I think has impacted a lot of people who come up to me with those worries.
You wrote that if we asked you this question 20 years ago, you would have said, "Yeah, no, this is bad for us." What turned you around in the last couple decades?
Well, it's true. 20 years ago, when I first went online, I was a bit of a nerd, so I was early into this in the early 90s. I thought, I was a bit of a misanthrope too, I think. and I thought, wow, this is terrible. The average person isn't very smart, and they're going to go online and will say stupid things, and it's going to drown out all the intelligent people, and this is bad for society. But what happened is that I'm a reporter, I'm a magazine reporter, so I would be just working. I was interested in this area, I wanted to know what people would actually do when they had the ability to communicate online, communicate publicly to other people, to talk. And so I was constantly writing stories about, instant messaging came along, and I would talk to people and watch what they were doing with it. And other tools came along, and I kept on discovering that my gloomiest concerns were not really coming true. A little bit, obviously there's a lot of silly things people say online, but I was failing to predict the really amazing things that started happening when people were able to, en masse, think and talk and write in public and with each other. I completely didn't see things like mass collaborations like Wikipedia, or the way that you get these hilarious things, people taking, Amazon review threads and hijacking them for political satire, or even the rise of a high level of literacy in photography and video, the way we're now seeing people becoming really elegant communicators in these modes that were never before possible. I didn't see that coming, and so that has made me much more optimistic over time.
One concern I've seen is that in the old days, we relied on our own brains. We couldn't just look something up online, so we had to think it through. We had to have discipline in remembering facts and remembering the things we need to know to get through a day. Now it's at the touch of a button for us, or a click of a mouse, I suppose. Our brains aren't exercising. They're getting flabby because we're not doing this. Do you buy that?
I used to. I used to worry about that deeply because I thought that I discovered that I couldn't really remember any phone numbers anymore. They were all in my phone, and I thought, well, this is a metaphor for the fact that I can't remember anything anymore. But the truth is, when you look at the history of how we have managed our knowledge, it used to be 2,000 or 3,000 years ago before writing became common that it really was all in your head. You had to remember everything, and so when writing came along, Socrates was very upset by this. And in the Phaedrus, which is this terrific dialogue, he said he warned about the arrival of writing. He said that knowledge that's written down will not be in men's souls. It will not be anything we actually know. It won't be true wisdom. And in a way, he was sort of right. Once you write things down, you don't need to memorize them anymore. But he failed to foresee that when you can write things down, when you can store them outside of you, you can consult with a far wider range of ideas and information than ever before possible, and you can have new forms of ideas. And that's what we built libraries for. What's happening now with Google is something in some respects is even weirder. We're using tools like Google or Evernote or our smartphones, when we're pinging them for little bits of information, we're actually behaving the way we do with other people. This is called transactive memory. It's the fact that when you're around someone who you know and trust, you start realizing what they're good at remembering, and you sort of don't bother remembering it. You know that they'll know it. And if you're in a long-term relationship with someone, you've probably seen this. I and my wife will be arguing, how come you can't remember where the keys to the car are? And she's yelling at me, how come you can't remember this? Well, it's because each of us knows the other person is in charge of doing that. We trust each other, and we're close to each other, and so we're constantly talking to each other for social memory. And social memory is a very, very big deal. It's part of what makes us smarter when we're in groups of people. We're just adapting now to bring in all these devices we have around us into these age-old habits that we've used for centuries to make us smarter.
We had Edward Glaser, author of Triumph of the City, on this network a while back, talking about the benefit of the city is that it brings smart people together to share ideas. Do you see the internet as expanding the city beyond any geographical boundaries and bringing people together and having that kind of collision of ideas?
Yes, I think that's exactly it. The thing about cities is that, in one sense, they're a real hassle to live in because they're cramped, and there's noise and interruptions, and we know that on a physiological level it stresses you out. But because we're so close to all those people, there's enormous creativity. You run into people and ideas that you wouldn't know existed. So it's a trade-off. We're willing to endure all the hassles of living in cities because of the creative and cognitive advantages. And it's very similar with what we're experiencing now as life moves online. We're uncomfortable with all these hassles, the fact that there's something, it can be overwhelming and it can be distracting to be constantly in touch with other people's thoughts. And we're having to learn how to sort of take time to screen those things out. But the upside of being connected to other folks and being able to eavesdrop on what they're thinking about, to throw questions out into the ether and get answers, it's just like being in a city. It ratchets up our creativity and our intelligence. And so we're finding our balance point with that.
Another concern, and you write about it in your book, is that we're interacting with people on a superficial level if we're on social media, say, and it doesn't count. We're just sitting at home. I think you mentioned the Alone Together book earlier. Are we opting out of real important social connections when we just communicate online?
I don't think so, actually. Every piece of evidence I've seen shows that people that are very promiscuous users of communications tools online, like texting or like instant messaging or whatnot, are also most likely to hang out with their friends face-to-face. Or to put it the other way, they're just very social people. And so when they're doing all that online socializing, it's a supplement to the offline socializing. I think there definitely are, you know, rare limit cases where people substitute online interaction from face-to-face interaction. But by and large, every time anyone has tried to look closely at these correlations, they find that promiscuous online social contact correlates really strongly to hanging out with your friends. And it sort of makes sense when you think about it, because, I mean, I'm sitting here, you know, I occasionally use, you know, something like one of those location-based tools like Foursquare that shows where people are. And, you know, I'll be sitting at home or I'll be out, and every once in a while, it doesn't happen often, but I'll get a ping and I'll notice that someone is actually nearby in my neighborhood. And it's someone I haven't seen for a while. And so I'll go, well, I'll text them, why don't we get together and hang out? This is a wonderful serendipitous discovery. I mean, the fact that you can become more aware of other people has many powerful mechanisms for increasing social contact for people that want it.
We're talking with Clive Thompson about how the internet age is changing the way we think. He says for the better. We want to know what you think. Has technology made a positive difference in your life? Or do you think all this technology is causing us to maybe get a little dumber? Call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation now with Clive Thompson about the ways technology is changing our minds, he says in many ways, for the better. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you worry that relying on the internet, going online too much, makes us less smart, or do you think it's a great tool that that makes us more effective, that helps us think more creatively? Ashley on Facebook writes, I believe that while we may have access to more information to make us possibly more intelligent, the many outlets of technology have put our brains on overload. Our brain no longer has quiet time, no time to process the day's events. What do you think, Clive?
Well, I absolutely agree that it is incredibly important to carve out time and regular time to be away from these connecting devices. Because, I mean, if you sort of grant the force of what I'm arguing here, which is that these new tools allow us to think in interesting new ways, so do the old ones, right? I mean, like, you know, Twitter helps you think conversationally. Sitting down with a book helps you think in a very slow-moving, deep, immersive way. And it's really important to still maintain a lot of those old habits of thought, almost on like a kind of a diversity level, like, you know, like plant, like crop rotation on to keeping a farm fecund. So I've found that a lot of the most astute users of technology have they pick a Sabbath period almost when they're off every week, you know, and partly inspired by them. I do that myself. I generally stay away from email on the weekends. I also generally, not completely, but generally stay away from social media. I don't check that stuff. And it's kind of nice to not be looking at a glowing screen for a long period of time every week. It really does help your brain move in those usefully different patterns. So I think they're absolutely right.
Well, the glowing screen in front of me tells me we have some callers. We'll go to Jason in Madison now. Hi, Jason.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. What do you think about this?
So, not so much social media I wanted to comment on, but just generally the internet. 15 years ago, I had a rare leukemia. There are only 600 cases diagnosed annually in the United States. And I spent countless nights till 2 or 3 in the morning every night till every entry of hairy cell leukemia in Google turned purple, as you know, after you've looked at it. And I found a clinical trial in Washington and a physician that administered it. And I know I never would have found it without the internet, and I'm now cured of the cancer. And it really comes down to the fact that I found this trial online.
Jason, well, I'm glad you found that, and I'm glad you're okay. That's a heck of a story. Clive, I've read about this, people finding medical treatment, also finding support groups, and researchers using the internet to pull together people who suffer from rare diseases like Jason's. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I've had some conversations with medical researchers about this, and I think early on, you know, 10 years ago, there was this understandable and legitimate fear that if, as patients, we went online, and I've certainly done it too, that we would encounter such a trove of stuff that would either befuddle us, or you'd wind up in one of these situations where you're in the discussion group where everyone's sort of peddling quack theories. You know, in reality, what doctors have found is that it's generally been better than that. People turn out to be slightly better consumers of health information than we would have hoped, such that now a lot of doctors tell me. I mean, I had a doctor who told me last year after diagnosis, he handed me the sheet and said, you know, just go Google this and read about it, basically. there's one definitely has to be, you know, careful, as I'm sure that gentleman was, that we know what we're looking at, but when your health is on the line, people can often be extremely aggressive, persistent, and critical thinkers.
Thanks a lot for the call, Jason. We've got Corey in Madison with us now. Hi there, Corey.
Hi. Just more of a comment than anything. Earlier you had talked about the technology, bringing, not being a replacement for social interaction or activity, but it also kind of brings people together, you know, for the reasons you mentioned. But I guess my comment is that when I see folks, you know, getting together, they're all just sitting there looking at their phones or their internet appliances, and they're not really interacting or doing anything other than they're in proximity to each other.
Thanks. And that's a common critique, that we're at an event, we're seeing something interesting, and we're looking at our phones. Clive, do you think that's a problem? Is that a concern?
If to the extent that it happens, anytime that happens, That's absolutely a concern. And I think that, like, there's definitely in certain communities and for certain people a sense of reaching a crisis point with that. I mean, that's what I think some of that concern is what people have tapped into when they've been worried about this. I think there's a fair amount of evidence from anthropologists and sociologists I talk to who go around and literally look at people's interactions. They say that they think a lot of people are starting to pull back from that over staring at screens moment. This happens frequently. Every time a new technology comes along, we get very excited by it. We get very obsessed with it. And eventually we realize that we're behaving kind of not very well to each other and we pull back. Mobile phones had this period where in the 90s, when they first came along, if you answered it, no matter when it rang, you know, breakfast, dinner table, in church, in your temple. And then it took about 10 years and a lot of mocking and poking fun at people for doing that. But eventually people stopped doing that. And now you actually rarely see it happen. I think the same curve, accompanied by social censure and mocking, which I think is good, is starting to happen with social media overuse right now. I regard that as actually very healthy to sort of poke fun at people for doing that.
Some people worry about the impact on kids in particular, being too attached to devices, too much screen time, that sort of thing. Is that something that you looked into in the book?
I don't look into it terribly closely, but I have definitely read about it and talked to a lot of pediatricians about it. I mean, by and large, it's a bad idea for kids to spend a huge amount of time staring at screens for all sorts of reasons. There's eye strain. There's the fact that ergonomically your body shouldn't be doing that. And we had the same problem with TV, you know, generations before. I don't think there's anything inherently problematic, though, with a limited and sort of judicious use of screens to do the amazing things that, the Internet can do. Because, you know, a lot of teachers have found, for example, that you have real trouble getting kids to write. You know, you need them to practice writing. They don't want to do it. It's boring. They're only writing for their teacher. But if you set up like a class blog and say, okay, we are now writing for the entire world, and other people start coming by and commenting on what the kids have written, you get this unbelievable sense of audience. It's so powerful, and the kids begin writing like mad, you know? So that's an example of using a computer in a way that taps into the amazing connective power that actually produces this really, really good educational outcome. You don't want the kid parked in front of the screen all day long, but there are amazing ways to use them if you use them with a good critical mind.
Jordan is with us now in Black River Falls. Jordan, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
With the whole, with what was actually just brought up was actually very interesting, but what I had called about was I just got back from studying abroad and I had made tons of friends and I'm a very social person, and social media has been a great outlet for me to keep in touch with my friends that I've made from all across the world. But, unlike my brother, who is a little less social than me, I feel like there's also the negative impact where you can kind of use it more as a crutch instead of a tool, and kind of live online like that. But which was interesting with which was just brought up about the blogging, I'm in a social media public relations course, and this past week we were required to get a Twitter and a blog to blog, and we have to do journal entries and things like that. And I feel like I didn't want to adapt into one of those online communities because I feel like that's something that you do get this general audience, and like a group of friends that you would hang out outside of the web socially, you do kind of want to keep up with that audience as well. It does kind of keep you online.
Gotcha. Well, thanks for the call. Talk about that. He's trying to use this as a tool and not, like he says, some people do, as a crutch. Can you wrap us up, Clive, by talking about that for a few?
Sure. I mean, I think when people use it really well and not as a crutch, when they use social media to stay in contact with friends, when it's done really well, they get the experience of what's called ambient awareness, which is the fact that if you're able to sort of notice just, you know, at the corner of your eye as you follow their tweets, their pictures, their utterances, all, you know, over a period of weeks and months and years, you can develop this fantastic mental model, this deep intellectual emotional model of what's going on with your friends who you can't see. I'm Canadian. I only get to Canada about once a year, but I have this very rich, textured sense of what all my friends are doing because we have this exchange. I think when it's used well, used mindfully and intelligently, that is a new experience that a lot of people are finding is incredibly rich for the way that they know what's going on in the lives of people they care about.
Clive, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Clive Thompson, author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better.
Coming up, two men in Appleton openly carried rifles and handguns near a farmer's market, and the police responded. We'll get your reactions. I'm Veronica Rickert.
I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.